Imagine building a skyscraper where every single contractor on the site uses a completely different measuring system.
Like the structural engineers are operating entirely in metric.
Yeah, and the interior framers are using imperial inches. And the window installers, they're measuring everything in this like bespoke, completely made up unit they just invented on a whiteboard last Tuesday.
So every single time a steel beam needs to meet a window frame,
the entire crew has to stop working, pull out a calculator, and just pray the conversion math holds up under pressure.
Which means the building faces endless delays. The whole structure is compromised by these compounding rounding errors, and your entire budget gets swallowed by the friction of translation.
The architecture itself becomes secondary to the administrative nightmare of just getting teams to talk to each other. And that absolute structural chaos, that was what building software looked like before 2026.
It was a mess.
Today, we're doing a deep dive into some really fascinating source material, specifically the W3C Design Tokens Community Group specifications, along with Malaka Venu's implementation reports.
We really need to look at how design tokens finally solve this translation problem.
Yeah, the mission here is to map out how these tokens became an incredibly, wonderfully boring standard foundation. We're going to explore why treating a token as an encoded decision rather than just mere storage is the key to unlocking the entire modern agent stack.
Because if you're dealing with design systems or software architecture, you know the old pain was deep.
Every tool spoke its own token dialect. You'd have teams defining their colors using SCSS variables in one repository, CSS custom properties in another, and then usually some bespoke YAML file acting as this highly fragile bridge between them.
Teams routinely burned weeks just writing conversion scripts to make their design files talk to their code bases.
Weeks. Just on scripts.
Yeah. A designer would update a hex code in a mockup, and then an engineering team would spend 3 days manually hunting down that color across 5 different code repositories, just to ensure the Android app, iOS, and the web platform stayed visually synchronized.
So the primary deliverable literally became the translation script itself, rather than the user interface. The friction was the job.
But October 28th, 2025 marks the pivot away from that friction. That's when the Design Tokens Community Group specification reached its first stable vendor-neutral version.
Officially designated as V2025.10.
Yeah, and that specific date is the moment the format stopped being a living draft and just became permanent infrastructure for the industry.
So what does it actually look like?
The baseline fields of this JSON standard are brutally simple. A token requires a $ value, a $ type, and a $ description. That's it.
Okay, but making the format entirely boring is the ultimate victory here, right?
Exactly. Well, the argument over the file shape is permanently dead. Because the structure is locked, the real work finally moves up the stack to architecture, governance, and actual design logic.
Okay, but help me out here. If you are listening to this and thinking a boring JSON format sounds like more bureaucracy, you are not alone. Standardizing a file structure sounds suspiciously like adding more compliance rules to the design process.
I get why it sounds that way.
I mean, I question why a designer focused on crafting fluid, engaging interfaces should care about the shape of a JSON object.
Because vendor neutrality means teams can switch tools without touching their downstream pipelines. Before the stable specification, adopting a new design tool meant rewriting your entire build process.
You discard months of integration work.
Yeah. The boring format is what allows the entire ecosystem to lock together seamlessly. A tool generating Swift code for Apple platforms now reads the exact same file as a tool generating CSS for the browser.
The foundation is fixed, so the tools become interchangeable.
The specification basically forces tools from competing organizations like Figma, Adobe, Penpot to ingest and output the exact same code structure.
So if you decide to change your design suite tomorrow, the code repository doesn't even notice.
It completely eliminates the vendor lock-in that plagued early design systems. A team can move their primary source of truth from, say, Token Studio to Specify without causing a single build failure in production.
Because the downstream consumer of the token just requests a JSON file formatted to the W3C specification.
The tooling layer is commoditized.
Okay, we should probably establish a rigid definition of a token within this ecosystem before we go further, because a token is not a variable.
No, a variable is just storage.
Right, whereas a token is a technology-agnostic way to encode a design decision so it survives a jump from the web to a native environment without requiring a rewrite.
Because a variable just holds a string of characters. A token holds semantic weight and references.
allowing the same source of truth to automatically generate CSS, Swift, and Kotlin simultaneously.
But to do that, the data has to carry the intent of the designer, not just the raw output. The system has to understand the relationship between values.
I need a concrete example of this. How does encoding a decision act differently in practice than just storing a hex code in a variable? Because storing hex 0052cc in a CSS custom property feels functionally identical to storing it in a JSON file.
The end result is a blue background on a screen share.
Yeah, so what's the difference?
Consider a core brand color. If you just store the hex code in a variable, you have an isolated string. But the W3C standard introduces first-class composite types.
What's a composite token?
It encodes a complex decision, like a shadow or a typographic scale. So a shadow requires an X offset, a Y offset, a blur radius, a spread radius, and a color.
Okay.
Inside that composite shadow token, you do not hard code a hex value. You embed a reference to the core brand color token.
So the composite token points back to the origin of the decision.
Mm.
It maintains that chain of logic.
Yeah, the shadow isn't just blue. It is specifically the brand blue, and the file reflects that relationship.
Yeah, and then what happens?
You push that composite token through a build tool like Style Dictionary 4. The tool reads the nested reference, resolves the brand color, and then translates the entire composite structure into the specific syntax required for the destination platform.
So it generates a CSS box shadow declaration for the web.
And simultaneously generates the specific core graphics shadow properties required for the iOS application. The decision survives the platform shift because the relationships are encoded in the file and the build tool knows how to unroll them.
I assume typography behaves the same way.
It does. A typographic decision involves a font family, a specific weight, line height, letter spacing. In the past, those were entirely separate variables just floating around the code base.
Yeah, an engineer would manually assemble those disparate variables into a CSS class or native text style, usually making translation errors along the way.
But the W3C specification treats typography as a single composite token. The designer defines a relationship between the font, the weight, and the spacing once.
And the compiler parses the $type field, recognizes it as typography, and formats the output perfectly.
Tailwind configuration on the web, Swift constants on Apple devices. The assembly happens in the compiler, not in the engineer's head.
But that automatic cross-platform generation relies on a strict internal hierarchy. The standard model enforces a required three-tier architecture.
Just three tiers.
Tier one is the primitive tier. These are pure values with zero semantics, like color.blue.500 or space 0.4.
Tier two is the semantic tier. This describes the purpose of the value, like color.surface.primary or space.layout.gutter.
And tier three is the component tier, scoped entirely to specific interface elements, like button.primary.background.
The most critical rule governing this architecture is the rule of indirection. Components must reference the semantic tier, never raw primitives.
Okay, wait, let me play devil's advocate here. Limiting a global design system to three tiers seems artificially restrictive. If you look at massive enterprise ecosystems spanning 50 distinct products, they seem to need more layers to capture visual nuance. I see 12-tier models deployed in large organizations all the time. Global, regional, brand, sub-brand, density, platform-specific layers.
The 12-tier concept is a toxic anti-pattern.
Toxic.
It is a hobby project masquerading as engineering rigor. Three tiers are the exact constraint that creates value. Anything more breaks the system entirely.
Why does it break?
Picture a developer trying to fix a bug in a 12-tier system. They look at a button and they have to traverse six layers of abstract aliases just to figure out where a background color originates.
So they're jumping from component to density to sub-brand to regional to...
Before finally hitting a hex code, the mental overhead destroys adoption. Developers will simply start hard-coding values to avoid dealing with the labyrinth.
Let's examine the mechanics of the indirection rule within the three tiers to see why the constraint actually works. Say a button component needs a background color.
If the button component points directly to the primitive tier, referencing color.blue.500, implementing a dark mode requires a developer to manually search the code base for every instance of color.blue.500.
And write a conditional override for a darker blue.
But if the button component references the semantic tier, pointing to color.action.primary, the component code remains entirely static. To trigger dark mode, you simply change the primitive value that color.action.primary points to.
The semantic layer absorbs the theme swap.
The machine repaints the interface. The component logic is completely untouched. That specific layer of indirection turns a massive visual overhaul into a 15-minute value swap instead of a months-long manual project.
So theming becomes a value swap injected at build time rather than a fork of the code base. There's no complex logic in the application for rendering visual states.
The build tool emits one CSS file per mode, gated on a data attribute like data theme dark. The application code simply toggles the attribute on the root element.
No JavaScript theme provider weighing down the client.
No duplicated tokens, no massive sets of manual overrides. The indirection creates the flexibility.
Let's look at what that flexibility looks like for a team in the real world. The source material highlights Malaka Venu's reported result, moving a brand refresh from 6 to 8 weeks of design and engineering work down to a single day.
Which is incredible.
Now, we should frame this explicitly as a direction to aim for, not a universal law of physics applicable to every legacy codebase immediately. But honestly, I harbor deep skepticism about a one-day timeline for a full brand refresh.
It sounds unbelievable.
A single day of work usually means one day of pushing a button after weeks of hidden preparation, undocumented meetings, and shadow engineering. A complex interface update taking 8 hours sounds like promotional fiction.
I get why you'd think that. But the timeline is grounded entirely in the mechanics of the continuous integration pipeline. The day literally consists of a designer opening a pull request directly from a tool like Token Studio.
And then what? The CI pipeline intercepts it.
Exactly. A tool like Style Dictionary 4 automatically runs, applies all the platform transforms we just discussed, and generates the platform-specific code.
Wait, so the pipeline simultaneously generates and deploys a storybook preview containing the updated components?
Yes. Storybook gives the team an isolated sandbox to view the new UI elements visually. An engineer reviews the pull request, just like application code, looking at the JSON diff and the rendered storybook visuals side by side.
So the machine handles the labor of propagating the changes across the code bases. The human effort is reduced entirely to review and approval.
And that machine labor also solves visual degradation.
Oh, this is huge. The stable specification introduces capabilities that previously required heavy manual intervention. The V2025 Put Tensever format natively supports modern color spaces like Okolch and Display P3.
Which permanently ends the problem of color loss across tools. Designers frequently define vibrant, wide gamut colors in their design files, only to watch them degrade into dull sRGB approximations in the browser.
Because the intermediate token formats couldn't encode the wider color space. The translation process inherently destroyed the data.
But the standard preserves the exact mathematical definition of the color from the design canvas all the way to the compiler. The output perfectly matches the original intent.
The review process we discussed earlier is critical, though, because a token pull request requires approvals from both design and engineering. Operating at that speed introduces severe governance traps that will destroy token systems if the pipeline lacks strict enforcement.
You cannot just change names and structures on a whim. The downstream impact is massive.
Renaming a token is a breaking change.
Treat renaming a token as a major API break. Teams must deprecate tokens using the $deprecated, true metadata field.
So you create an alias from the old name to the new name, flag the old token as deprecated, and rely on linting tools to warn developers using the legacy name.
If you just delete a token name out from under a consuming application, you will crash the build instantly. The design system team must provide a safe off-ramp.
The deprecation period allows consuming applications to migrate gracefully over a major version lifecycle, rather than forcing immediate global compliance on 50 different product teams.
And this brings us back to the fatal trap of developers circumventing the architecture entirely. Components pointing straight at primitives destroy the indirection we established earlier.
A system requires an ironclad linting rule. No raw color or spacing values can exist in component CSS.
If a developer hardcodes a hex value or references a primitive token directly in a component file, the continuous integration pipeline must block the merge.
That single enforcement mechanism guarantees the integrity of the semantic layer. Because if you allow developers to bypass the semantic tier, the entire system degrades back into the chaos we started with.
Now, a strong token system creates a highly structured vocabulary of named, described primitives. And that strict adherence to a standard vocabulary enables the final layer of value.
AI handoff.
Yes. The specific tactic here is publishing a tokens.md file alongside the software package.
Providing this context allows AI agents to generate user interfaces that stay strictly on brand. The tokens.md file contains the human-readable description of every semantic token.
So when an engineer prompts an AI to generate a settings page, the model consumes that vocabulary.
It avoids the stylistic uncanny valley because it builds the interface using the exact semantic constraints defined by the design team, rather than hallucinating generic styling based on its training data.
The AI operates within the boundaries of the design system.
Let me ask you a final question, though. If AI relies purely on this lintable standard token layer to understand our brands, what happens to the visual identity of companies that fail to implement this boring foundation?
A standard lintable token layer is exactly what lets the next layer of machine-readable systems exist at all. Get the foundation boring, and everything above it gets easier.